right? So, we got a situation here. We have a new president of these United States due to the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Bless you. He is trying in the summer of 1864 to run for and win a presidential term in the White House. While LBJ is not necessarily all focused on what's going on in South Vietnam, because he's trying to win, the last thing he wants is for something big to happen that will appear on the covers of the New York Times and the LA Times and, I don't know, Chicago Tribune and all the other major newspapers in the country. Because if Vietnam gets out of hand, that makes him look incompetent. But then something weird happened in the Tonkin Gulf. Now, granted, we got to be honest and fair. It was triggered by the fact that the United States was allowing the ARVN special forces to go and attack sites in North Vietnam. But the North Vietnamese pushed back. They sent out those torpedo boats. They fired at American ships, and American ships responded in kind. And in the end, people died. North Vietnamese soldiers died. Now, like I said, the administration couldn't figure out why on earth would the North Vietnamese do this. Why would they risk a direct military confrontation? Because after all, if you send your military vessels and they strike at American military vessels, that's a direct act of war. So, instead of making a big deal out of it, the president just assumed that it was a one-off. He's out on the campaign trail, doing his own thing. But then, 2 days later, on August 4th, something weird happens. Now, Maddox was joined by the C. Turner Joy, and they're both out patrolling in the Gulf, roughly about 60 miles off the coast, when storm stirs up in the Gulf. Winds, high seas. Well, the problem with such storms is it has a tendency to do wacky things with electronic equipment. So the sonar, the radar on the ships begin wigging out. Images appear and disappear, distorted signals, not quite sure what's going on. Well, the commander of the Maddox, Captain John Herrick, is absolutely convinced that these blips are in fact the North Vietnamese coming back. So, he gives orders to both ships to open fire. They start shooting at these blips on the radar. They also began engaging in, you know, military maneuvers. He also calls in for reconnaissance planes from nearby aircraft carriers. But it wasn't until several hours did Hedrick and his crew, and all the pilots circling above, suddenly realize that nobody actually saw a single ship, an enemy ship. Yeah, they were the blips. They were firing at the blips. But there was no wreckage. There was no signs that they had hit anything. There was no sign that there was ever anything there. But nonetheless, since none of you have ever served in the military, when the naval vessels engage in such operations, they begin issuing reports that eventually make its way back to Washington, D.C. And needless to say, LBJ was not amused. He was rather perturbed. And because that image is up there, I realize everything is going to be screwed up. Why? Because not only does the president get military briefings, so does Congress. So the last thing he wants is Congress to investigate, because in Congress there are Republicans. And if the Republicans get a hold, I mean, if you pay attention to the news, you know what the Democrats and Republicans do to each other. One member of Congress sees something, they say something, they leak it to the press, and then next you know somebody else does it, and they're engaged in their partisan bickering. Well, the last thing he wants is the Republicans to start leaking that, look at what the United States Navy is doing. They're shooting at ghosts. Must be the Commander-in-Chief's fault. So, he tells his advisors to use the phrase, "We're being tested. We're being tested." In other words, even though the Navy officials on the area realize that they were phantoms, that does not get shared. Instead, the phrase, "We're being tested," becomes symbolic that the North Vietnamese are playing games. Somehow they're messing with our equipment. They're making it look like they're there, only hoping that we'll preemptively do something stupid. All right, this is going to bug me. I got to stop this for a second. I'm going to fix this animation. Where is it? Is this it? No, it's not that one. Sorry, I'm going to find what this is. All right, that's down at the bottom. How is it not on the top there? No, it's not there. Not there. There. Oh, there he is. I don't even know which one. So much work I put into these stupid things. So much work and nobody cares. Where's the edge? Ooh, that's a big one. Alright, let's see how this works now. There we go. Alright, there's LBJ. Alright, there we go. So, to convince members of Congress that the North Vietnamese are messing with us, he orders airstrikes. And they begin bombing isolated targets in North Vietnam. He then calls on his Democratic allies in Congress to push through a resolution condemning the North Vietnamese actions. So what I'm literally trying to say is that he is lying. He knows he's lying, and he's lying to save face. But it's not enough to convince the Democrats in Congress. He needs to persuade the American people. So the President of the United States goes on to the television and speaks to the nation. Of course, we can see that the schools, them, their internet is working spectacularly as always. Come on. I should see if I can rip these videos off of YouTube and just embed them in the PowerPoints. But then the files are huge. I don't know. Come on. Play.
Clear that our government United and its determination to take all necessary measures in support of freedom and in defense of peace in Southeast Asia. I have been given encouraging assurance by these leaders of both parties that such a resolution will be promptly introduced, freely and expeditiously debated, and passed with overwhelming support. And just a few minutes ago, I was able to reach Senator Goldwater, and I am glad to say that he has expressed his support of the statement that I'm making to you tonight. It is a solemn responsibility to have to order even limited military action by forces whose overall strength is as vast and as awesome as those of the United States of America. But it is my considered conviction, shared throughout your government, that firmness in the right is indispensable today for peace. That firmness will always be measured. Its mission is peace.
America! We want peace, so we'll blow you up. Now here's the dirty little rub, and I've already told you, but we'll put it on the screen so you can add it into your notes. The truth, is that LBJ knew it did not happen. He knew what had taken place. Why? Well, because after the initial wiring, Hendricks submitted a follow-up report, a series of them. And after his final conclusion, he said the following, and I quote, "The review of action makes many reported contacts and torpedoes fired to appear doubtful. Freak weather effects on radar and overeager sonar men may have accounted for many reports. No actual visual sightings by Maddox. Suggest complete evaluation before any further action takes place." Now here's the thing. The initial report from Hendricks went to Congress. After that occurred, LBJ ordered all future communications only go to the White House. So the members of Congress never received the follow-up report. But instead, LBJ relied upon the initial report, and he used that initial report to convince Congress to support the resolution. At the same time, and he alluded to it, when he was giving the speech, American military fighter jets had taken to the skies and engaged in what is known as Operation Pierce Arrow. You can see the map up here. They selected several military coastal targets and engaged in 64 sorties with aircraft flying from the USS Ticonderoga and Constellation. They hit four bases, and they destroyed most of North Vietnam's oil storage facilities. Additionally, they also launched sweeping attacks on their harbors, and they destroyed 25 North Vietnamese torpedo boats. They also destroyed many of the docks and the harbor infrastructure and took out what is estimated to be 10% of North Vietnamese oil reserves. Now, the North Vietnamese never recorded casualties. People definitely had to die, or at the very least get hurt. But we just have no idea. But during Operation Pierce Arrow, the first two American aircraft would be shot down when the North Vietnamese responded with anti-aircraft fire. The first pilot killed in the first wave of sorties was Lieutenant Richard Sather. He was shot down piloting an A-1 Sky Raider, which, as you can see, is actually a prop plane. These would basically fly in low, just a little bit above the waterline, before quickly elevating and dropping their payload, and then flying out. Well, his plane got hit and blew up in air. His remains were never found. And then shortly after Lieutenant Sather, Lieutenant Everett Alvarez Jr., he would be shot down piloting an A-4 Skyhawk, which is a jet, as you can see over there. But Lieutenant Alvarez would become the first American pilot to become a POW. He would be held in the famous Hanoi Hilton for 3,113 days. He would not be released until February 12, 1973. Now, unlike the Special Forces strikes, America had directly struck at North Vietnam. Under the Constitution of the United States, in order for the United States to engage in direct military action, the president must send a resolution to Congress, and both the House and the Senate must vote in favor of it. That would result in a formal declaration of war. But that's not what took place. Because as the president alluded to in the video, he was communicating with Congress, but he didn't want a declaration of war. Instead, he wanted a joint resolution. What's the difference? Well, if you declare war under international law, other nations can get involved. So instead, Congress tried being clever. Without formally declaring war, they would pass what became known as the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. This was a bipartisan measure embraced by Democrats and Republicans alike. Interestingly enough, it passed unanimously in the House, 416-0. But in the Senate, it passed 88-2. Now, what makes this document significant is it would change the way the United States fought wars forever. And by the way, this is why, technically speaking, Vietnam is not a war. It's a military action. This document would give to the President of the United States war powers. He would be allowed to use American military forces without having to declare war. How? Well, Congress is the lawmaking branch. This essentially was a law that allowed the POTUS to do whatever he felt was necessary to assist South Vietnam. Up to and including boots on the ground. Well, here's the funny thing. I should have used a different picture. Because he kind of got a little grin on his face. But there's another version of this picture. I don't know if it was taken before or after this one. But there's the Tonkin Gulf resolution right on his desk. He's got a big sheet-eating grin on his face. Because as he told McNamara and his other advisors, this document, it was like grandma's nightshirt. It covered everything. For the first time in the history of the United States, the President of the United States has the authority to do whatever he wants, up to and including the use of nuclear weapons, without congressional consent. All because of ghosts. Questions? Now, at the same time, as we said, LBJ is running for the presidency. Every 4 years, no matter what's going on in the world, even during the COVID pandemic, there is a presidential election. So once he had the War Powers Resolution, LBJ had his little piece of paper. He knew he would use it at the right moment, but he would spend the rest of the spring or the fall, September, October, worrying about the campaign. He was rarely in D.C. Instead, he was crisscrossing the country, giving speeches, going in parades, shaking hands, kissing babies. Now, ironically, he actually had a very strong opponent. And he mentioned him in his speech that we just watched. His opponent was Senator Barry Goldwater, Republican from Arizona. But LBJ was a brutally shrewd politician. That's why he mentioned him. Because look, in his speech, even my opponent agrees we should be taking action against North Vietnam in this. By doing so, Goldwater had no third lane. He was basically trapped in the same box. LBJ was able to portray himself as a very strong, patriotic defender of American liberty and security. He proclaimed that he was reasonable. But then he pivoted on Barry Goldwater. And in one of the most brilliant political moves in modern campaign history, the only thing that I can make an analogy to, and it wasn't even that Trump did it, it was Biden did it, was over the summertime when they had the debate. And it was clear how brain dead Biden actually was. You know, think of the line that Trump used against Biden when Biden was talking about something. And the president, well, Trump basically said, yeah, I don't even know what you're saying. You know, brilliant. Well, you want to talk about political brilliant? Vote for me and I'll do the right thing around the world. Vote for my opponent and you'll get this, which would be the first major political attack ad in the history of American elections that would be aired on TV. There's gonna be a better way to do this. ready for this? This is the ad on which all modern attack ads are based. Nuclear war. I know you guys don't care, but you know something? You should. This is what politics are about. Well, why are we doing it again? Additionally, in addition to portraying Senator Barry Goldwater as a complete psycho, he's also telling the voters, knowing that he has the authority to do whatever he wants, that very simple, that we are not ready to send American boys to do the fighting for Asian boys. In his campaign speeches, he would use the phrase, "We seek no wider war." In other words, you vote for me, and there's not going to be escalation. But yet, and again, this is the flaw of American politics. Most American voters are idiots. Morons. They are what political activists refer to as useful idiots. They can be told anything, sold anything. And again, if you're paying attention to what's on the news, what's going on? All the Democrat activists are saying all Republicans who voted for Trump are idiots. And all of the Republicans who voted for Trump are saying all the Democrats are idiots. It's constant. But there's truth to both sides. Because we are emotional creatures. And we vote for things that move us down here. We feel. One thing we don't do is think. We don't analyze with rational, laser, focused thought when we go into the voting polls. So what LBJ is doing is like, look, you vote for my opponent. He's a psycho. I'm not going to escalate anything. What he's not saying is Congress gave me the authority to do whatever I want. He's not going to say that on the campaign. But you know what he doesn't do? Not once in his speeches did he talk about an exit strategy. Instead, we're not going to escalate, but we're not leaving. Well, I don't know how good of an arm you have. Alright? But if someone is sitting up against the back of the wall, and you got a bucket full of baseballs, and you just keep throwing, and throwing, and throwing, eventually you're going to hit them. So if he had no intention on escalating, but he's not going to withdraw our troops, And by the way, there are now thousands of troops there, and they're going in with the ARVN. They're engaged in the operations. And now, by the way, now we're also bombing North Vietnam. It's only going to be a matter of time till something bigger happens, which is going to result in the escalation. So essentially, he is lying to the American people. But you know something? It worked. It worked. Just like what the Democrats did to Trump in 2020. Just like what Trump did to the Democrats in 2024. It worked. And you want to talk about a landslide. All across the country, it was Democrats. Look at this electoral map. Just about the entire country, with the exception of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 southern states, is blue. LBJ carries 44 states, wins 486 electoral votes. The Democrats pick up 37 seats in the House of Representatives, pick up 2 seats in the Senate, giving them a veto-proof majority. FYI, in our Constitution, Congress can override a presidential veto, but it takes a 2/3 vote. Well, the Democrats had so many votes, again, it's called a veto-proof majority. If they wanted to, they could actually veto the president, and there's nothing the Republicans could do about it. It's been very rare in American history where one party has had that much control over the Congress. So by comparison today, what are the Republicans? They control both chambers, but I think they only have 56 senators. You know, they need to get up to 66. That's probably not going to happen. And in the House, the Republicans barely control the House. I think they only have like 4-seat advantage. But in 1964, 295 to 140. Whew, crazy. So what does this basically mean? Well, LBJ is in control of the country, and he can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, and no one is going to stand in his way. And what does he do? Well, if you ever take American history, actually, we don't even teach. They used to call it American Nation. Do they even offer that anymore? I don't think I've taught American history here since like before COVID.
I took a UConn American history.
Yeah, but not here. Yeah. What I'm saying is not here. Well, in 1964, when LBJ secures re-election, he launches what's known as the Great Society. And the U.S. government class that I teach at QuinSig, which we talked about this is a period where the United States got as close to socialism as you could get. Basically, one party had control over all of the reins of government, and they used the national government to control the states, to control the local towns, and to control all the businesses. So, LBJ would spend most of his time focused on domestic policy. But he didn't ignore what was going on in the Republic of Vietnam. He still received frequent briefings. He still wanted to remain in the loop. But at the same time, he still didn't know what to do about it. There was no easy solution. Why? Well, the people who are in charge of the South Vietnamese government, spearheaded by General Khan. If you recall, it was LBJ that allowed Khan to coup Minh. And it was JFK that allowed Min to coup Diem. So by August of 1964, Khan has basically beaten down all of Min's supporters, crushed any remnants of the Diem government, and he wants more power. Why? Well, just like Diem. Soon the Buddhists began to protest, as did the students. But they began protesting the presence of the Americans. It got so bad that Khan would declare martial law, would suspend the Constitution, which only triggered violent protests. And in the end, Khan would agree to end martial law, but the protests continue. No Buddhist monks set themselves on fire like it happened on Dien's watch, but the Buddhist leaders were calling on Buddhists to basically withdraw, to drop out of the army, to drop out of the police, which made up the majority of the population, and basically let the Catholic Vietnamese fight the war. And all the while, the VC are sitting back applauding. They're loving this. So, to counter the Buddhists, Khan quickly shifts. And he pledges to create a new government, to hold elections. And this new government was going to create a new constitution, to have a civilian government. But before they could have an election, they needed a civilian leader. So Khan appoints Phan Quoc Xu. He would become the president. Well, it should say RVM, but it looks like the white corner of the image in there is kind of cutting it off. Republic of Vietnam. So he would be the civilian face of this new government. Which, of course, caused Phan Quoc Xu to start trying to make decisions like a president. He wants to kind of mold the Constitution. He wants to create something similar to the system that the French have, where there would be a parliament, but there also would be a president as well as a prime minister. But then when the generals realize that would basically mean the generals of the military no longer have power, what does Khan do? Khan coups them. They dissolved the National High Council. They arrested civilians. They ousted President Xu. And once again implemented martial law. But he triangulates. He realizes the majority of the people are against the Americans. So to make this move popular, he declares that this new Republic of Vietnam government would be independent from foreign manipulation. In that it would be opposed to colonialism. Needless to say, U.S. Ambassador Taylor was not pleased. Because if you recall, it was Taylor who got Khan in. So, the president now has all this authority. He doesn't want to get us deeper mired into Vietnam. He wants to focus on the Great Society. But the problem is our quote-unquote a lie is a nutcase. Talk about a Hobbesian choice. LBJ realized there's no diplomatic solution to what's going on in South Vietnam until you got a strong South Vietnamese government. There would be some in the media, the American media, that called on the United States sitting down with both Hanoi and Saigon and trying to negotiate a settlement, which he rejected. There also were members of his own administration, as well as Congress. He'd call them war hawks, who basically began saying the best way to win the situation is to basically blow up North Vietnam, to pound them into dust. Now, ironically, at the same time all this is going on, he holds an interview in the Oval Office with Turner Catledge of the New York Times. One of the things that LBJ used to do for posterity was whenever there was a visitor in the Oval Office, he had a secret tape recorder set up. And there were mics everywhere. So he essentially would record the conversation. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever talked to the press, but I have. I'm a selectman in my town. So I've talked to our local reporter several times. And when you talk to reporters, you have on-the-record conversations and you have off-the-record conversations. Once they were done with the official responses, they're holding an off-the-record conversation, and LBJ basically admits, and I quote, "We're in bad shape in Vietnam, yet we can't afford to, and we will not pull out." That's called the Hobbesian's choice. No matter what decision you make, it's only going to be worse. So, if we can't bomb our way out, and we can't negotiate our way out, what are we going to do? Well, he realized that the 23,000 military advisors in South Vietnam were not enough. So he sends cable to Ambassador Taylor that read, and I quote, "I am myself now ready to substantially increase the number of Americans in Vietnam if it is necessary to provide the kind of fighting force that can win against the Viet Cong." Before he even takes the oath for his second term, he's going to escalate. Questions? Guess who did not have an issue? Guess who did not face a Hobbesian choice? Well, the VC. They were fighting a war to overthrow the South Vietnamese government with hopes of unifying with North Vietnam. At the same time, LBJ is having this moral dilemma. The VC launch an offensive. All throughout South Vietnam, the VC units begin popping up everywhere, out of nowhere. And the goal was to basically expose how weak the United States actually was, how vulnerable they were to attack. Up till December 1964. The Americans seemingly were untouchable. But now, the VC was going to get them. So, literally beginning on Christmas Eve, December 24th, the VC began launching terrorist strikes hitting American targets. Sometimes they would be small, blowing up a Jeep here or there, shooting at an American GI that was coming back to the base a little intoxicated after spending time with a hoochie coochie mama. But beginning on Christmas Eve, 1964, they got deadly serious. Two VC agents would drive a car bomb into the basement parking garage of the Brinks Hotel, located in Saigon. That hotel is where many of the American Army officers had been staying. The hotel was booked out completely. Well, when the bomb detonated, they managed to kill two Americans, including Lieutenant Colonel James Robert Hagen, who himself was a 20-year Army veteran and had been working for MACV. His body was recovered. He was crushed to death when the floor above him fell down and landed on him while he was in his bed. Probably never even woke up. Also killed was David M. Agnew. Now, he technically was a civilian, but he was a contractor for the Navy. His job was to go around Saigon and find real estate that could either be rented or bought by America to house military infrastructure. He famously managed to find for the CIA one of the tallest buildings in Saigon that they would rent out until they pulled out of the war in 1973. Then, a month later, 400 members of the VC would stage an attack on a base, military base, called Camp Halloween, which is where the pilots stayed who flew planes out of a base at Pleiku, which was a Army Air Aviation, or actually it was technically an Air Force base, just south of Hanoi. Well, a bunch of VC had been reconning the base, and they realized that the base, which housed these American pilots, was guarded by basically paid South Vietnamese security officers. So not even ARVN regulars. They also watched them, and they realized that on any appointed time, there were somewhere between 40 and 50 of these security personnel that walked the perimeter or stood in the guard towers. But at night, the South Vietnamese stopped patrolling the wire. They basically stayed in the watchtowers. So, at 11 p.m. on February 6th, a unit of 400 VC crept out of the jungles, crawled along the ground all the way up to the wires, the barbed wire fences that surrounded Camp Halloween, cut holes in the wire, and penetrated the base. Then, at 1:50 a.m., they launched their attack. They detonated explosives. They opened fire with their AK-47s. They launched mortars, striking the tents where the Americans were sleeping. In total, they would kill 7 American pilots and wound another 104. Plus, they killed dozens of the South Vietnamese. They would also destroy 10 aircraft and damage another 25. Did this defeat the Americans? No, but it was an act of terror. Because now, even if you're sleeping in a base, the VC is going to get you. Sleeping in a hotel, the VC is going to get you. Well, when LBJ got word of what happened, he authorized the same day Operation Flaming Dart. Flaming Dart would begin on February 7th, 1965, and I believe it would last until November. No, I'm thinking of another one. This was a one-day operation. Sorry. 49 fighters were launched from aircraft carriers and would target North Vietnamese military bases as well as VC logistics centers along the DMZ. Pounding them from up on high. No idea how many casualties. But now we got a situation of tit for tat. The Americans attack us. Well, now we're going to attack the Americans. Then the Americans reply, so we're going to attack the Americans again. Then 2 months later, the VC completely regroup, and they launch one of the boldest attacks yet. Beginning on May 10th, 1965, 2,500 VC would overrun the provincial capital, Song Bi, of the Phoc Long province, 60 miles north of Saigon. They literally overran the entire city, occupied it. Why? Well, their target was an American airbase that was in the city. The VC fought so fierce that the U.S. actually had to deploy special forces. They barely managed to stop the VC from overrunning the base. It took snipers, it took mortars, it took F-4 Phantoms dropping cluster bombs to actually break the VC. Well, when they gave up on the base, they retreated to the town. And they held the town for 4 days. Until eventually, ARVN Ranger units would begin engaging in house-to-house fighting. It got so bad, literally, they were fighting with swords and daggers, hand-to-hand, face-to-face. But eventually the VC would be driven into the woods. 85 VC were killed, 49 ARVN, 5 Americans. But that didn't kill the VC. No, they came back the next month and they attacked another provincial capital, Dong Xiu. Song Bi is in the north, Dong Xiu is in the south. They're literally everywhere. This time, the VC struck at an ARVN base, completely overran it, seized the base. The ARVN would attempt to respond by bringing in reinforces, but the VC surprised attack them. Then ARVN paratroopers were brought in, and they too were overrun. In the end, it wouldn't be until Westmoreland would authorize the use of the American 173rd Airborne Division, the Screaming Eagles. They, working with their ARVN allies, would eventually drive the VC out of the base. But this was not just a sudden wave, only to rescind. The VC continued to strike. By July, August, September, the VC are everywhere. They're constantly attacking. ARVN casualties are going through the roof. They would rise to over 3,000 per month. Soon, ARVN soldiers are fearful. They begin to desert. ARVN officers are rattled. They start making stupid tactical decisions. One of the biggest things they began doing, they start deploying their armored personnel carriers, using that as kind of mules, how to get from point to point. Well, the problem is that if you send in heavy armor without infantry, the bad guys are just going to be in the bush offside the road. They're going to get up and they're going to fire an RPG. Kill you all. Things were spiraling out of control. Everything was looking fine. And now the poop hits the fan. And by the end of the summer, Saigon is panicked. They begin preparing to evacuate 5 of the northern provinces to basically pull back all of their forces to give all of that ground to the VC. Well, when Taylor wires McNamara, McNamara has a strong sit-down with the president. McNamara basically tells LBJ it's time to make some tough choices. It's possible we're going to lose this war. Well, LBJ then wanted a second opinion, so he calls in William Bundy, who is the Assistant Secretary of State in charge of East Asian Affairs. And Bundy essentially says the same thing as McNamara. You know, if we leave these 23,000 advisors in and we don't unleash them, the ARVN is going to lose, which means we're going to lose. So, both men agree. If we don't act, we're going to suffer a defeat. I'm going to call it there.
We'll pick up with Operation Rolling Thunder when we come back on Thursday.
All right, since some of you don't understand the concept of when class begins, I will share the same spiel that I shared with the half that was here on the time. One, attendance. If you recall on the first day, I told you that this class has an attendance policy. You are allowed to miss 4 classes without penalty. Every absence 5 and above, you're going to lose 3 points off your final average. As a result, some of you may fail this class. 2, we got our 3rd exam coming up soon. The 3rd exam will be online. I'm going to be looking to see if you guys try cheating again. Hopefully you do not. That will be worth 15% of your grade. And then after that, you have your paper, which is due on April 22nd. That counts as 20% of your final grade. And then you have your final, which will be in person, closed notes on paper. That counts as 35% of your final. So, if you haven't figured out how to study yet, you might want to start practicing, because you're not going to have a choice on the final. So, we will reconvene on Thursday. We're going to see what happens with Operation Rolling Thunder. We're going to see with the arrival on the boots in the ground, and we're going to see what LBJ decided to do to kind of fuel these boots on the ground, being one of the most controversial decisions of the entire war, which we shall lovingly refer to as the draft.